The following program, Globalization, the Undermining of Democracy, was sponsored by the Madison Institute and held in Madison, Wisconsin on November 18, 2006. The featured speaker was Edward Friedman, a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His specialty is politics and the world economy, with a focus on the impact of China as a rising economic power. In his talk, he explains how today's globalization works to undercut democratic values and weaken democratic governance. Is there any hope? Professor Edward Friedman.
Good morning. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. I'll begin with where I'm going to end, since the question is there any hope? Schiller has a poem which ends with the line, "There's only hope for the hopeless." I'm going to end pretty hopeless, and maybe the only way when you hit bottom is up. I'm right now engaged in what you might call a globalization project. I'm part of a project in the what they call the foothills of the Himalayas. It means it runs from about 10,000 to 14,500 feet, and you can see peaks which are 25,500. You can see 100 miles away because there's nothing in the air, which is quite an extraordinary experience. The place is miserably poor. It's on poverty alleviation and sustainable development. Tourism is just destroying the place at an unbelievable rate. This is the place where three great rivers of Asia are within 50 miles of each other, and there's a contest for which one will be polluted first. Anyway, there are many ways to define the present age of globalization. One way is to think which is the rising power. You can think about the age when Britain rose. You can think about the age when America rose. You can think about this is the age when China is rising. And then you can ask yourself, what's the impact of that? Well, China is the world's leading anti-democratic nation. And you can easily see the consequence of that in a place like Burma. Burma is an absolutely useless military dictatorship. When I say absolutely useless, I mean that while AIDS spreads out of control, they will claim that there is none, and they will do absolutely nothing about it. So it's an absolutely useless place. Democratic candidate won a democratic election, getting almost 85% of the seats, for which Aung San Suu Kyi was rewarded by being put under house arrest more than 10 years ago. The international community was going to sanction Burma. China offers Burma economic help. Burma's economy is rising in a gross, unequal kind of way, but it's definitely rising. India cannot allow its neighbor Burma to be a place where the Chinese have predominant influence and give it naval bases and allow its pipelines to go through, so India forgets about democracy and makes up with Burma. And the United States is going to do that tomorrow or the day after. The world works in terms of Gresham's law right now. The bad drives out the good. What's in circulation increasingly is the bad. And the major way that occurs is in terms of money. And you might just think about yourself with money, or think of your neighbor who isn't as moral as you with money. Here's how the bad drives out the good. Imagine you're about to get on the bus and you had to pay. And in one hand you have 6 American quarters, and in the other hand you had 6 Canadian quarters, which are actually worth 50 cents less. And you have to decide which one to drop in the coin box. Well, you drop the Canadian money in the coin box. Why do you want to give them the good money? You hold on to the good money. That's how the present world, the stuff that circulates is increasingly the bad, the cheap, the devalued, and so on. And that is basically the logic of today's globalized economy. The bad is going to drive out the good. Another way which you might just think quickly about the present age is to think about it, again, in terms of what are the rules of the game in terms of who is in charge. Long-distance exchange has been part of the human species from time immemorial. The easiest proof of that, as the biologists like to say, is how we share our genes. As long as you needed even a little bit metal to make your sword stronger or your armor tougher so you could survive in war, you would go any lengths to get where those metals were. And it's a wonderful book by McNeil called The Pursuit of Power, which just follows how international exchange went from the beginning of time in terms of what you needed for war. And the other reasons you had international exchange from time immemorial was religious purposes, whatever you needed for your religion, from holy places to go to, holy books to read, whatever you needed to put on your altars and so on, you went anywhere you could get those things. And then whatever money you had or whatever you could exchange, those who had the most of it always wanted the best of anything. Spices, gold, jewelry, silk. So international long-distance exchange has been us with time immemorial. Whoever's in charge is usually able to impose their rules. The first time someone is really, really in charge over a long distance is the rise of China between 450 and 1450. The whole area is dominated by something called the Chinese tribute system. China is a silver-based economy. Chinese silver really runs the show, and everybody has to go to China to get it and to be part of the system. Europeans begin to rise. Europeans are backward people in a cold climate who live in caves while most of the rest of the world is civilized. And eventually Europe does rise, starting about 1450. And the way I like to say it is, if the benighted Europeans could rise, then anybody can do it. Eventually Britain will become a dominant power by the end of the 19th century. British sterling's tied to a gold standard is dominant. They run the world in terms of banker's logic. Banker's logic is not good for growth. Banker's logic is not good for equity. Banker's logic is good for banks. This really becomes proved to the whole world in the 1920s. It is Britain's banker's logic which really is the major cause of the Great Depression and leads to an end of international trade. And then we all get on to fascism, Hitler, World War II, and all those other wonderful things. At the end of the war, a new way of doing economics was put in place, which you know as Keynesian macroeconomic management and the creation of the Bretton Woods system. And this is the world of the 40s, the late 40s, 50s, and 60s into the 70s, when you could have growth with equity, you could have the creation of a broad middle class, you have the creation of a welfare state. The essence of what makes it work is, this is an economist, you can control money at both ends. That's the key to it. If a government, in order to make macroeconomic management work in the interest of growth with equity, it can't allow freer flow of money into the country or out of the country. Because bankers' logic, if you are in control of a lot of money, you'll always vote against equity because you can make more money somewhere else on inequity. So you've got to prevent those SOBs from doing that. And at the end of World War II, for whatever reason, and there's great debates of what the reasons are, everything from Roosevelt's hatred for the J.P. Morgan family to the failures of the banks, which helps get the Depression started, the United States was a leader in imposing this Bretton Woods system, which controlled money. And business had been so hurt in the by the Depression that they went along and were supporters of this macroeconomic management. Well, this system all comes to an end somewhere in the 1970s. And basically what has happened is we have a yet more intense form of banker's logic, international banker's logic, now in control of the world. They care about preventing inflation, keeping money solid. They don't give a damn about jobs or equity. Once again, it's simply the logic of what it is to be them and how they make the money and their ability to impose that on the world. The real proofs that this age had come occurs at the end of the 1970s and the beginning of the 1980s. British labor tries to continue a policy concerned about equity and the welfare state, and the money all flees Britain. This is what helps bring Margaret Thatcher to power. Because labor's policies can be trumped by the power of international money. Mitterrand comes to power in France at the beginning of the 80s. Similar socialist policy, the money flees France. Mitterrand has to cave in too. And so if you think about the 80s, you think about Reagan and Thatcher. And Reagan and Thatcher are really simply the representation of this new logic which has risen by the middle of the 1970s. Now what makes it possible is uncontrolled money. You cannot control money at both ends. And just to remind you of what it means, on any day in the world today, 70 times as much money is traded as goods. When you hear about free trade agreements, What matters in them is seldom the trade of goods. What you care about is looking at how they're talking about intellectual property rights, patents. That's where the pharmaceuticals, and that's where they make their real money. And the focus on the trade in goods is usually to confuse you and make you not see what's really happening in a very different kind of world, where the way you make money is with money. Now, you are all, I assume, complicit in this international banker's logic. I assume that I am certainly. Just do a test. You can make so much money with money today that everybody wants to be a bank. So if you go into any store, the first thing they want from you is that you use their credit card. If you go and buy a car, they want you to finance it in GMAC credit, Ford Finance, whatever it's going to be. Money is the way you make money, not with the goods. Ford at times make more money on its financing than it does on its products. How many of you are sitting in, are carrying credit cards which have some corporate logo on it? Can I just see? Sure, me too. I have a United Airlines Visa. So you're all guilty. You're all guilty. We are all complicit in making this creates money, and that's how you make money, and it can't be controlled by the government. You are what is called, when you carry that card, a non-bank bank. Every time you spend money, you have created money. Someone has trusted something. God knows if it's going to be paid. And basically, that is the logic which has now spread all over the world. The moment it occurred was with the oil price spikes of the 1970s. Suddenly, $300 billion flowed out of the richer countries into, just take as an example, Saudi Arabia, which at that time had 6 million people. What was it going to do? In 1 year, it suddenly had $80 billion extra dollars. If it brings the money home, all it gets is inflation. Everybody is subsidized for everything already. Everything is essentially free. So they got to invest the money. Where do you put the money? Banks. Which banks? Banks which no one knows what they do with your money. They don't want it to be downtown here in Madison, Wisconsin. They want it to be at banks where no one can find out where the money is. And you get the rise of this out-of-control money. You can no longer control money at both ends. Keynesianism is dead. You cannot do it that way anymore, because money can just vote against you in humongous amounts as never before. Offshore banking grows. The city in London, the banking center in London, is totally deregulated by a Thatcher, so it can play any of these kinds of games. You win in those kinds of games. Britain tends to be, most years, the world leader in foreign direct investment, the world leader in where initial public offerings of new stocks occur. It's the leader in inventing new instruments that you can play games with these monies, derivatives, hedge funds, don't worry what they are, but they're all a consequence of this absolutely new world. On top of this new world, you can hear inherently has a logic in it which doesn't give a damn about equity or jobs or anything that you might care about. And it has great power to impose itself. It could already, by the early 80s, impose itself on Britain and France. This is not a matter of imposing itself just on third world countries. Of course, it can do that too, and everybody focuses on that. But it can do it on everyone. That's the key thing. Come a number of other changes, which in total create what I like to call the new moment in globalization. Globalization has been with us for time immemorial, but it works by different logics in different kind of eras. By the 1970s into the 1980s, you have Boeing 747s, the beginning of faxes, satellites in the sky, so you can have cell phone technologies instantaneously, large ships carrying containers. And suddenly the cost of transportation and communication declines over 95%. And you can now break up products and produce parts anywhere in the world and then put them together anywhere in the world. And the only one who's in control was the one who's in control. It weakens the power of governments. You can see from the loss of control of monies on, governments are in trouble. Governments means democracy. It means the ability of voice to have any say. There's a disgusting language out there. It's actually even in one of the textbooks I assign. I try to explain to my students how disgusting it is, but they're so socialized to it, they actually believe it. They say you are empowered because every time you spend money, you have a voice. That is democracy. It's not democracy. If everything were market and nothing were politics, there'd be zero democracy. You'd have people with money running the show. But that logic to try to persuade you that the market is a superior democracy is out there in public consciousness. But what's really happening is a great weakening of the ability of a voice, human voice, to have an impact on these kinds of things. So the result of this ability now to do business in any parts all over the world in any way creates what is called the New International Division of Labor, called in the Americanese NIDL. Can't put it in an acronym. It doesn't go into the American language. And NIDL allows what basically happened. China rises because of it luckily is able to take advantage of all of these things in the 1980s. It just happens to be that China in the 1970s was still under Mao's rule, and so it didn't get carried away by the OPEC price spikes when everybody else thought commodity prices would just keep going up and the banks had all these petrodollars and they borrowed all sorts of money. And then after the second OPEC price spike, that's when Khomeini comes to power, the Russians invade Afghanistan, there's a huge second price spike. And then there's a depression, which I still like to call the Reagan depression. It hits Wisconsin badly. If you can remember farm crisis back there, back in that time, Harley looks like it's going to go under. It needs relief. And the third world countries go bankrupt. And China enters the world after those events. So it's fortunate to escape all of those events. And it enters it at a time when it has been so hurt by Mao's policies that, and it's seen Asia elsewhere rise, that it wants to go into the global economy big. And it does so when bankers' logic has led to an increase in the value of currencies in Asia. Japanese currency in 1985 will increase 35% of value. They can't then export to the United States, and China says, come here. And suddenly all of Asian wealth goes investing in China. 80% of foreign direct investment in China is from its Asian neighbors, mostly ethnic Chinese. And it simply is the winner. Now, there's something to be said about this which is non-trivial. Because after 1991, when India begins to open up to this logic and take advantage of foreign direct investment and the new international division of labor in ways different than China, it too has begun to rise. And if the poorest countries can rise and wipe out poverty, most of the poverty that has ended in the world since China began to rise has been done in China and India. Most of the rest of the world fears getting involved with this or can't carry out the political transitions to get involved with this. And so they are outside of this world. And when you talk about increased polarization on the globe rather than in each country, most of the poorest are those people who are not suffering from globalization but who are suffering from being outside of globalization. They are not able to take advantage of it in any kind of way. You can just think of poorest places in the world and they'll all fit into, from North Korea to failed states in Africa to Haiti to wherever you want to look. Now, a big question which comes up in this is, has the world changed in absolutely fundamental ways? And one of the ways this is experienced is, who benefits from trade anymore? Now, the first point I'd like you to remember is trade is a little bit less important than it used to be, that money is really ruling the earth. Intellectual property rights, patents, licensing, ability to set up your banks, things which are called in economics invisible. It's not a good that's being transferred. But the question still gets raised. It used to be the understanding that everybody benefited from international trade. And everybody benefited from international trade because they produced things in which they were more efficient. But it seems to me that there was a hidden logic. The reason why that was so is because most of the price of the good was not the price of the good. As you all know, if you were to be asked the question, when you buy a cereal, what percentage of the price goes back to the farmer who grew the original oat, bran, wheat? You all know the answer is around 2.5%, right? That's normal because most of the cost of a good are what are called transaction costs. It's the person who processes it, packages it, advertises it, warehouses it, puts it on the shelf, sells it to the end consumer. Well, the transaction costs have collapsed. The transaction costs have collapsed because of the decrease in the price of communication and transportation. And so increasingly, the labor price has become decisive. Labor price was only one factor of many in the past. And that means the cheaper the labor, the better you are able to compete at the lower ends, and increasing not just at the lower ends. And so you are seeing a logic, a Gresham's law, in which you are all aware that in the richer countries, you're having an experience of what is called hollowing out, that great middle is shrinking. This is true even in places like Taiwan, let alone Japan and Europe. By the way, Europe is most afraid of it for a whole series of reasons we don't have to worry about. But there's no doubt that hollowing out is occurring all over the world. And it's also occurring because if you have lots of money, you can hide it, and you don't have to pay taxes on it. If you have $1 million cash, there's no reason you should have to pay taxes in terms of handing your money over to some person who can play by the new rules of the game, and the government will never find your money. And just to show you that you, too, can be part of this criminal enterprise, let's say that you went down to a bank in Madison and bought traveler's checks. And let's say you bought them in euros, okay? You can do that. And you bought them because you thought the euro was going up in value against the dollar. And you just held on to them. And then 6 months later, the euro was up, say, 33%. So you went back down to the bank and you cashed them in. And they give you now, say you get $1,000, they now give you $1,333. You have made $333 in 6 months. And who knows? Where's it written? Who has a vision that you made a penny? It's off the books. It's off the books. So it's very difficult to find money that's made in the new money. So it isn't just that you make the money, but you don't have to pay taxes on it. So why would you produce a product where everybody knows about it, and then you're going to have to pay taxes on it, when you can make money with money and no one knows you made it, and you don't have to pay taxes on it? So that logic, which works against the producer and the middle class and the tax burden, because rich can get away with it more, is on the middle class. And the reason why the middle class feels a burden is because it's burdened. And what the middle class gets wrong is then scapegoats the poor. It blames them. Why are my tax burdens? It's because of welfare and stuff like that, right? And because the other stuff is invisible. And to understand it would take some time. So we have some very bad logics at work here. The big question is this system sustainable? Is this system sustainable? For the moment, one can say this. The basic logics at work, which everybody understands, is this is a very volatile system. Volatile means that in the Keynesian world, in the pre-Keynesian world, you had U's. You can see U's going up and down. Keynes tries to even them out, so they're very small U's, so you don't have shocks. Because the worry was if you had big shocks, you get Hitler coming to power. And that's not a good thing. Now, volatility means we have V's. Instead of U's, we have V's. It really can crash. And the question is, can the world sustain those kinds of traumas? Increasingly because safety nets are shredding. And we all know that safety nets are shredding. Not because the Social Security system is in trouble. I'm sure everyone here knows that that's a fraud line said by certain people for their political interests. But private pensions are in trouble. You all know that all sorts of corporations, because the rules are written so they can do it, are writing off and getting away with it. My brother, who's retired from IBM, has watched every year his health care and pension that IBM promised him just go away. Premiums go up until he's basically all on his own, and you're powerless to do anything about it. Private pensions are going away. And local pensions are increasingly in trouble because local pensions tend to be invested in this very volatile market. And if you make a wrong bet, as just happened in San Diego, you wipe out the county's pension fund when you do that. And there is a healthcare crisis in the United States too. And the healthcare crisis, interestingly, I see not just in the 40 million that people say are uninsured, I see it with my students. They graduate, and then they want a year off to see the world. Uh-oh, no health coverage. No health care. What do you do? What do the parents do? Whatever it is, it's going to be expensive one way or the other. So you have a system which is no longer a system. You really have this banker's logic and these other kinds of things that we've never seen before in the extent which they're working, running the show, and you can't even almost understand them. You can't get them under control. The first person who figures out a way to put together what you might call a new Bretton Woods for the present era gets not only the Nobel Economics Prize, but also the Peace Prize. But meanwhile, many people fear that it really is like we're back in a post-World War I moment in which you cannot stop the forces that will make for some trauma. And therefore, globally speaking, democracy is in trouble. Because people will, and you can see this happening in places in Latin America today, people then respond to some demagogue who promises some easy way out. So I did promise and I that I would only do an introductory chat and stop and so leave time for questions.
I heard that during the Second World War, the industrial output of the United States quadrupled. And I wondered what effect that had on the economy post-war.
The dominant view at the end of the war, because what you just said is true, we had a depression, then we had a fantastic increase in production, was it wouldn't be able to be sustained. And so everybody was expecting a Great Depression to occur again. And what you really saw at the end of the war was this kicking in of this new Bretton Woods Keynesian system. And as you all know, what happened is mass consumption took off and did very well, thank you, and it wasn't a problem at all. But people had in their heads, as the war came to end, that previous era, which would have, if you were still running your economy in the way you did in the post-World War I era, you would have had a disaster. And now you are once again essentially running an economy in many ways like they did in the post-World War I era. So looking ahead, it's a little bit scary. But the real answer to your question is that Keynesian Bretton Woods system really worked unbelievably well. Anybody who plugged into it did brilliantly.
We went off the gold standard in the early 70s, about the time there was an oil spike in the Nixon administration. And I know there's a school of thought out there that feels we really should be returning to a gold standard. And I was wondering your comments on that, please.
Right. On August 15th, 1971, Richard Nixon delinked the dollar to gold. Up from in the whole Bretton Woods era up to August 15th, 1971, 1 ounce of gold would get you $35. It was absolutely unsustainable because in this new era in which money began to float around, everybody believed that the dollar was not worth. 1 ounce of gold shouldn't get you, let me get this right. Money works in a counterintuitive way, so you have to check yourself to say it because it's always the opposite of what you think it's going to be. If you were French and you had $35, you would immediately go get an ounce of gold because you know eventually that the dollar was losing its real value. It's increasingly becoming paper. So there was a run against the dollar, and there was no way of stopping the run against the dollar. This was really the beginning of the so-called euro currencies beyond the control of the European governments, the offshore banks, which are often British banks, Virgin Islands. Anybody ever been to Grand Cayman? I went to Grand Cayman, wanted to go do business in one of these offshore banks. So I wanted to see what they were like, so I walked into the bank. I had my traveler's checks, and they all laughed at me. I mean, no one wants to talk to you to change traveler's checks. They want people who have serious amounts of money to play with it. I was laughed out of the bank very, very quickly. But anyway, so the dollar loss, what's a dollar, what's the present, how many dollars for an ounce of gold? Anybody know?
$475.
Yeah, it's many hundreds of dollars. So you couldn't have sustained it. And so you have a floating currency kind of system. Money is now just another commodity that is traded. There's no way of changing that unless you had some currency that was powerful enough to impose its will which you don't have, or if you had an agreement between all among all the dominant economies in the world, which you're also not going to have, among other reasons, because Luxembourg, Britain, America, and China are all doing very well in terms of playing money games in the present system, and so they're not going to change. So we're stuck. We're simply stuck with the present system, unless something changes at that kind of a level.
We have the problem of global climate change.
Yes.
But huge amounts of money are being spent for weapons. What role does this money market madness play in this, and can it be changed?
Well, one of the consequences of money being out of control is it makes it easier for international criminality, because you can't find the money, and so it's easier to wash money for drugs, smuggling people, or smuggling weapons. And so, of course, international criminal business is way up. And if you don't know, when George W. Bush was elected president of the United States, the Congress had a bill which, for the first time, essentially tried, and the European banks all wanted it to happen too, to join together to close down criminal money, to try to put some limits on this criminal money. And Bush decided that got in the way of free trade. Now, he got a second view on that after 9/11, when somebody told him that the money that paid for that benefited from being able to slosh around in these kinds of ways. So I have the impression that in some half-hearted ways, we have tried to control it. But it's only half-hearted because so many entities are really making lots of money on this money. There really is a lot of money to be made on it. And you don't carry that non-bank bank in your pocket for any other reason than it's in your monetary interest to do so. Well, you and I are trivial in terms of that non-bank bank. The people who have real reasons, they're going to keep winning the game.
You left us hanging in a way, saying we're stuck, etc. But what is your hope for the future?
My hope is that younger people would do better. And I don't know the answer to that question. When I say, began with the Schiller quote, there's only hope for the hopeless, your only hope is, sadly as I see it, is that a catastrophe will occur, like the Great Depression, Hitlerism, World War II, of such a kind that you'll have to change because no one is going to want to live that way anymore. And that's an awful hope, isn't it? So you don't want, there's only hope for the hope. I don't have a good answer to the question. When I finish my course on politics of the world economy, I cry. It just isn't very helpful. But let me stick with our question. I think you can approach it from another point of view, though. What little thing can you do in your own country? If the real danger is these Vs, these traumas that can go, this volatility, well, you should do the little you can to make sure at least that doesn't occur in your own country. And how do you do that? Well, you all know the answer to that. You want high floors under everybody. You want to make sure there is national health insurance, so in case you lose a job, you can still at least pay your medical costs. You want some kind of higher wage at so that everybody in some sense is taken care of in the system. You want some kind of serious retraining. You want some kind of quality public education that's available to everyone. You want some kind of a system so that even when these things happen, there's hope in the society. You all know that. That's about the only things that are in our control, and you have to hope that other people in other societies are going to do similar kinds of things so at least these worst case things don't occur. But that level of what's happening at the global level is really so powerful and out of our control right now, it's quite frightening. But I think, as you all know, and I'm sure we all equally care, we should be doing those other kinds of things, because those traumas, that volatility, it's guaranteed to occur. And it can be disastrous.
It seems like one of the big problems with global trade, and China in particular, is that their yuan is, I think, like 40% undervalued. So it's like anything we would produce here in Wisconsin, we're at a 40% disadvantage. So is there any way that pressure can be put on the Chinese to increase their value, or is this something totally useless in terms of what you've been describing?
It's the latter. And it's even a teeny bit more complex than that. While I think without a doubt that the Chinese currency is intentionally undervalued, that is part of the overall East Asian strategy of growth, is you intentionally undervalue your currency so your goods are low priced for purposes of international trade. And this was the Japanese were the first to do this well. It was copied by Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea. And China is now doing it. The difference between China and all the others is 1.4 billion people. And that just has a weight beyond 6 million people in Hong Kong that is, you know, you can do the multiple. But because of new international division of labor, any Chinese product that is exported has lots of imported parts involved in it. And it's more difficult than you might think to figure out what the actual impact on China would be of these changes in prices because of how much, because it might turn out to be that much of what it imports will then be lower priced, and how much it actually will have an impact on the Chinese exports is not clear. What really is having an impact on Chinese export prices is the overall improvement in the economy. And China is no longer the low-wage producer on almost anything. It's the Bushes in Vietnam, because Vietnam can undersell China on almost anything. Bangladesh can undersell China. India can undersell China. What China's advantages have become are much more like advanced country advantages. The ports are fantastic. The infrastructure is great. The hotels are very pleasant to be at. It's a great place to do business in many, many kinds of ways. If you try to have things come out from Vietnamese, Indian, Bangladeshi ports, you can be there 6 months before the good gets out. You have to buy, when you buy for season, stuff for Christmas can't arrive in January. If you do it in China, you do have all these benefits. One way to think about this Chinese advantage is the multi-fiber agreement. As some of you may know, the multi-fiber agreement was an agreement that existed amongst the richer democracies, which said for importing apparel, we will give out quotas so we can decide how much we will import any year. It was a way of protecting your own apparel industry. People often say textiles. Textiles is a high-tech industry. You don't have to protect textiles. American textiles are globally competitive. Textiles means the cloth that you're wearing here that you want to be soft and waterproof and hold its color and be able to be washed in the machines. That's a high-tech chemistry industry. America is an exporter of chemicals. Apparel is something which gets sewn, knitted on the little machines. Anybody can be trained to do it in a very short period of time. America is not competitive in apparel. Anyway, the view was you gave out these quotas. And Bangladesh had so much of a quota, and the Philippines and Indonesia and Dominican Republic and Haiti, and everybody had a quota. Poor countries of the world says you're only doing that to protect your own apparel industry. Absolutely true. So they said, therefore, for purposes of fairness, to help the poor catch up, we want to do away with the multi-fiber agreement. Let the market decide. And 2 years ago, the richer countries, always referred to as the OECD countries, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD countries let the MFA disappear. Well, what happened? China became the big winner. Producers in Bangladesh went to China, not because it had the lower wages, but because it had synergies from, you know, they had the guy with the buttons and the guy who did this kind of sewing, put the whole kind of thing together. And they had all that great infrastructure and easy getting money and nicer hotels to stay at. And the poorer countries got hurt by it. Because it isn't always the lowest wage guy that wins. There are other things that matter here. Anyway, the answer to your question basically is China will allow its currency to get valued up when it is afraid of something else happening to it. That is, if there were Europe, America, and Japan in agreement were saying when we should restrict Chinese imports, you begin to have an effect. But Chinese are very good at playing the rich off against each other. If we do something they don't like, they buy Airbus instead of Boeing. If Japan does something they don't like, they buy Siemens instead of Panasonic, or VW instead of Toyota. And they make this very clear. The first time they made it clear was over human rights at the end of the 19s. The Danes, who take human rights very seriously, the Danish Constitution is a human rights commission which has the power to veto laws which it decides are bad for human rights. And they also have the power to walk into any institution and to see if things are being run according to human rights, and if it's not, arrest people, close it down, and so on. So Danes take human rights very seriously. Don't know what's wrong with them. And so they annually introduced a motion at the United Nations Human Rights meeting in Geneva to investigate China's systematic abuses of human rights, because there are systematic abuses of human rights in China. It's the world leader in Netizens in jail, people who use the web. It's a world leader in journalists in jail. It's a world leader in a lot of things. And the Chinese simply punished them, said, we will not accept any more trade delegations from Denmark. France said, okay, we will stop introducing such motions in Geneva. Chinese said, come on in. And how'd you like the $2 billion contract for the Canton subway? And everybody in Europe got the idea, and the United States still, at the end of the Clinton administration, didn't get the idea, and it went through the ritual. It was really only a ritual, because we really weren't serious, of introducing motions to investigate China's systematic abuses of human rights. And so the Chinese get very angry. When Bush became president, they punished him. It was actually because they were upset with Clinton, but they punished him, and they got the United States voted off the UN Human Rights Commission. So they are doing very well winning the game, and it doesn't look like anybody else is going to be able to join together to do something about it.
As globalization becomes more solidified and we actually will have some rules or government, then we could have control over how it treats one another. And if we then put a high floor above the other countries, we could actually, if we handled it right, move in a direction that was more fair.
If you had nine major countries come together and agree, you could make that happen. Don't hold your breath.
We had World War II, yeah. How economically the United States got out of the Depression. Now we have the Iraq War. How much is our economic systems depending upon wars? And
I think the only place the United States system is dependent on war at all is research and development, because of the idiot way we run things. It's easier to put scientific research and development money into the Pentagon than any place else. So everything from the web to Boeing 747s originated in big expensive things done by the Department of Defense, so they ate the costs of research before you actually had a commercialized product. I think other than that way, we run a lot of things, so the costs of products in advance are eaten by the Defense Department. I think the answer is zero.
At this point, Professor Friedman left for another engagement, but a lively discussion continued. We now hear excerpts from that discussion.
One of the most depressing things about Professor Friedman's lecture this morning to me was that there is this vast criminal world out there that we have absolutely no control over, that they do whatever they want to do, and any effort by the part of the United Nations or individual governments have no control over them at all. I think that is the most frightening thing that I heard, and that it was put in a dimension that was so much stronger than I had heard it before. There has to be a way of getting them under control.
I found our presentation this morning very disturbing, a little depressing. And one of the things that I think that he omitted or did not touch on really was the issue of global governance. He certainly did tell us about all of the things that were happening, the movements of money, the movements of technology, the movements of so on and so forth, but without any indication that there was the need for anything more. I think we have to agree that we have a United Nations system which is, if not broken, at least is weak. It is founded on principles that were perfectly valid in 1945 and are not valid in 2006. And I think we must begin to look at how we move global governance up to the level of beginning to deal with all of the problems that the professor indicated that are common in our everyday knowledge. We talk about the disappearing of the fish species in the world. We talk about the continuing hunger of 800 to 900 million people every year. We talk about waterborne diseases that kill 2 million children every year. We are absolutely splendid in analyzing all the problems. We are a little less elegant in terms of trying to figure out how to change the system of international governance that we are faced with. We have two models that we can look at. We have Paul Kennedy's absolutely brilliant book called The Parliament of Man, The Past, Present, and Future of the United Nations. First base, I disagree entirely with his title, and I think it's an extraordinarily cynical book, because what does it say? It says that no improvement can be made except perhaps incrementally. And I think that those of us in this room that look at world problems today believe that incremental change is not going to do it. I think a far more hopeful and far more positive approach to how we should look at world governance has been written by a Turk by the name of Kemal Derviş, who is at the present time the head of the United Nations Development Program, and a book called Better Globalization, which is a, I think, imaginative, brilliant, and extraordinarily possible revision for the United Nations system to bring it into line with the governance problems that the world faces. And I think we should all look very carefully at what Kemal has said and begin to focus on that. It is Derviş Sedilla, which in Turkish is Derviş.
It seems to me that, you know, we are talking about we want to go global or not. Globalization is here, and we're sort of in the Wild West stage of globalization. And once you have a country or a government or a world that has rules and justice systems and regulations and some control over it, you can avoid some of those. Just like when the United States was finally founded, even the people in the Wild West eventually realized that we all do better with justice and with rules that we can trust. This is the challenge of the 21st century and of this generation. We have at our heels the likelihood, if this terrorist war keeps going, of nuclear holocaust. If we don't do that, we still have the environmental holocaust on our shoulders. We have no choice but to solve how we're going to make globalism work. And we have to solve this problem or the jig's up.
I think we're dealing with two very basic, not only philosophies, but drives in our human makeup. And I come to that because of a little paragraph that I read in one of the books that we reviewed some 2 years ago on our round table. And don't ask me what the title and the author is. But it quoted the oldest written document in the Western world that deals with political situations and governments. Comes out of Athens, of course, in about 300 BC. And it says that a good government consists of three principles. One is that it must be approved of by the people that it governs. Two is that it must have some sort of legal judicial system that keeps people behaving properly, and three, that there will always be a minority that will be greedy or power hungry, and you have to keep track of them and keep them under control. Now, these are words of wisdom that have grown with me when they say that you must have a judicial system that goes beyond a judicial system that has to do with behavior in a social structure, that you cannot live like a wild animal, that it has to do with being civilized. And the other thing is that the very basic drive is the insecurity that all of us carry with us. I think insecurity is a very basic motivator in all human behavior. And if that gets exaggerated, you begin to amass a substance to keep you going and to amass power to give you the means to assert yourself. And I think these two drives will be with us all of history. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't control them and that we shouldn't hope to get a resolution between the two of them.
We've talked about the landmine tragedy some years ago, and that was handled by some countries going outside the United Nations system and setting up their own technique for a treaty. And it's worked. Even the United States has been following its provisions unwillingly without signing the treaty. But the countries have willed that this kind of thing go into place. And Norway has now said, all right, you've gone against the matter of cluster bombs because the United States and China and company say that they're still useful. And they're going to start again by setting up a treaty that all nations may sign and eliminate. So there are alternatives if we press the people who represent us.
Well, just a footnote. I'm very glad that Tom brought that up. Because I think there is also one thing that we tend to overlook when we look at the landmine treaty. The landmine treaty was basically a movement of non-governmental organizations. It was started by a few determined people, not governments. And the issue was carried on a worldwide basis that forced governments to act. And I think this is a tremendously important message that we all keep in mind, that it is possible for people, if they get together and are determined, they can cause governments to change their minds and to do things they hadn't thought of doing. I think we keep forgetting about people power.
I'd like to comment on the question of what we can do. By we, I mean the U.S. There's one thing which I think is important, and I'll not only point it out, but also a few comments about why it ties in. And that is, we should be putting massive federal spending into building a really first-class rail system for transportation, integrated with bus systems for more local traffic and so on. First of all, doing that creates jobs in this country, so we can't be accused of protectionism, but the jobs will be created in this country, and contracts would go to businesses in this country, large and small. Second thing is, as segments of that system come into use, they will make our economy more efficient, and they will make our quality of life better. Third thing is, there is no single step you could take that would be more useful toward reducing the threat of global warming than getting a first-class public transportation system. Fourthly, of course, everybody's saying, where does the money come from? This is one thing where borrowing makes sense. When the Bush people borrow money so as to give a tax cut to people whose incomes are $1 million a year or more, then they spend some of that on luxury items and they invest some of it in China, which doesn't help jobs here. This would be an investment in our country, and borrowing for that purpose is a good thing. every enterprise borrows to build up its structure and then begins to realize the benefits of it. So there are several reasons why that really ties in to the globalization issue.
Everyone talks about how complicated these problems are and how hard it is. And I think that books like The End of Poverty detail very creative, realistic, doable things that would solve tons of problems. We know what to do. What's complicated, I think, is what's not spoken is we don't know how to solve these problems without hurting the people who have the money right now.
It seems to me that what we can take away from the meeting is that Mr. Friedman doesn't really know what to do about the macro problem, but his prescription is for micro solutions just to cut off the peaks and valleys of the radical seesaws that might come otherwise. These are in no sense solutions to the major problem. The health care, the minimum wage, education, and safety net, and even if we add on the transportation improvements, are necessary, and we're all for them, and we should get about doing them, but the other problem is still out there. And it's related, as I see it, to our media problems, not getting the information we need because these same people are running the media outlets, and to the revenue problems we have because they're setting our tax policy, our revenue policy. Those are problems down the road that we have to get at. We have to get at some of the revenue problems in order to do the intermediate prescriptions.
Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.